Welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. We are coming to you, 3 days after when we last recorded, or at least the first part of the show will be recorded then.
Quick turnaround.
Yeah, it's a quick turnaround. But, you know, that's what you do when you get paid the big bucks.
That's right.
I am Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
And this is going to be kind of an experiment in Fox on Sports history. So mark your calendars. Today's August 6th. We'll record the second segment August 10th, but we're going to do it from the road at the PGA tournament at Belle Reve in St. Louis, Missouri.
That's right.
So that will be interesting. It'll be a fun experiment. We just kind of worked out well, unless my flight is delayed, which would really just bite. And anything's possible. But when you're going LA to St. Louis, they used to do that in covered wagons back in the day. I just don't want to get dysentery. I feel like all I've done for the last 2 weeks is make Oregon Trail jokes and references. They go well in the dad joke realm. So anyway, a lot going on in the world of sports. Not a lot in the last 3 days, obviously, but PGA tournament is taking place this weekend, as you might have guessed from that brief portion of the intro. And, well, I guess since we talked, the Red Sox have laid waste to the Yankees.
They sure have, times four.
Yeah, weird.
Four-game sweep. Speaking of quick turnaround, it wasn't too long ago that the Sunday night game ended.
Right,
That was a late Sunday night game, Yankees-Red Sox. Not surprising, because they like to play long games. But this was a low-scoring, lengthy affair.
Well, the funny thing is you go from the Porcello game, 2 hours and 15 minutes, the shortest game since 1994 between the Red Sox and the Yankees. You go from that to the typical Sunday night affair that these guys play, which they always seem to take far longer than they actually should. Like you go to one of the men's softball games and it feels like a one pitch tournament because everybody's swinging. You go there and everybody's working counts. And I guess that's kind of the way of the world as far as baseball goes now, is lengthening the at-bats. And we both read an article talking about pitchers working outside of the strike zone this year. That's kind of been the flavor of the month. And throwing pitches that might look good, but your brain plays tricks on you. That last 15 feet when they're coming in on you, you can't see the ball. So if you're a Lance McCullers Jr. throwing for the Astros and you have a ball that has a lot of spin, and it just blows my mind the things that we're able to mention to measure now. But if you throw a ball that has a lot of spin, it's going to have a late break. That makes you a better curveball pitcher and most likely a better pitcher because what you're throwing is breaking late. And for all intents and purposes, players would talk about it disappearing, and it does. But you look at that, the Red Sox, for whatever reason, in that four-game series against the Yankees, really had a mastery of what was going to be a strike and what was not going to be a strike.
Yeah, and that was in stark contrast to what happened to the Yankees. And it all came to a head last night in the ninth inning when the star closer for the Yankees, Aroldis Chapman, takes the hill with a 4-1 lead. And with two out and two men on, he still had that 4-1 lead. And after the blink of an eye, it turned into a 4-4 tie. He'd blown a save for only the second time this season. He'd converted 22 saves in a row. But it was just an off night for him. He's throwing 101 miles an hour, but he couldn't find the strike zone. He had 39 pitches in that ninth inning. Only 19 were for strikes.
I guess what that always points to me is, he was having an issue. He said he was having a bad outing. He got done in by a throwing error on a play that probably should have ended the game. But there is, and we saw in the postseason last year with the Dodgers, or at least I was probably the only one out here who watched it, but Rich Hill was throwing well, and Dave Roberts, the manager for the Dodgers, looked at his numbers and said, based on what the bullpen is, this is the time I'm going to pull Rich Hill. And it was, if memory serves, it was the fourth inning. It was ridiculously early. Hill was not terribly pleased about the fact he was pulled. The Dodgers did their manual of, we're going to go to this guy, 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 and Kenley Jansen's going to close the game in the ninth, and one thing leads to another. You are relying on everybody to just do their job, and I get that because they're being paid a good amount of money to do their job, but by the same token, if any one of those guys doesn't do their job, you wind up in a situation where you have a guy who's completely out of his role now coming in to close a game, and the mental burden of the fact that your closer, the guy who's up there on a pedestal, has now been beaten and yanked from a game, and here's this guy that has been languishing on the bench that all of a sudden, okay, throw so-and-so up, get Pedro Baez up. Like, that doesn't, it's just, it's mentally, it's a lot to overcome. And the Yankees did that last night where they went through their bullpen in lockstep, kind of how they would, and then they wind up with Chapman having some difficulties in the ninth inning. I was thinking of better baseball euphemisms that I can't use. One of my favorite baseball expressions. If you know me, you know the expression. I'm looking at you, Junior. But it's you walk into a situation where your closer pees his leg in the ninth inning. That is not the expression. And then what? Who comes in now?
And not to mention, you blow a lead in that game the way that they did. The Red Sox had all the momentum in the world. It seemed like a foregone conclusion that they were going to win it in extra innings. And it's going to be fascinating to see how the rest of the regular season plays out for the Yankees. You know, during the broadcast, Alex Rodriguez was talking about how he thought Aaron Boone should manage this game like it's Game 7 of the World Series. The Yankees had lost the first three games of this series in Fenway, facing a four-game sweep. They really needed this win to have a chance to stay in the race, you know, let alone momentum. And he was talking about, you know, getting to their bullpen like you're talking about with all those great relievers they have. Robertson handing it over to Zach Britton and then giving it to Chapman. It was shaping up exactly how the Yankees would draw it up to get that one win, salvage a little bit of respect and momentum. But instead, you know, Chapman just had an off night at the worst possible time. And now, you know, the Red Sox have basically put the division away, and their pitching staff, you know, they've got a lot of confidence coming out of this series. You mentioned Porcello. In that second game of the series, he had a complete game one hitter,
yep,
with nine strikeouts.
Yeah.
And then their new pitcher, who they just acquired in a trade, Nathan Eovaldi, he's throwing 100 miles an hour, and he has an excellent outing. And then last night it was David Price, who's had a lot of trouble against the Yankees, finally getting a quality start. So in a series where they don't have Chris Sale to sweep the Yankees, oh man, what a statement for the Red Sox.
Yeah, the Red Sox came up really big in that one. I think it's lucky for Aaron Boone that George Steinbrenner isn't around anymore.
Yeah, right.
Because he would be gone.
Yeah, I mean, they're only...
He would be sent packing only to be hired the next year after Bob Lemon took him to the World Series or something like that. But that's old school Yankees. But they are very fortunate that Aaron Boone, like I said, lucky that Steinbrenner's not the boss anymore, because he'd be in deep trouble. And the other thing that you look at, it's like I don't know about my chances with Chapman there, but I really love my chances if it's Jonathan Holder on the mound in the 10th inning.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, and no disrespect to him. He's a major league pitcher, good pitcher. However, any day of the week, I would face a guy versus the guy.
Right.
Any day of the week. So Red Sox come out of there with a four-game sweep. It's now a 9.5 game lead. And I know Yankees fans, I can already hear the Yankees fans who are my friends talking about 1978.
They're going to need something like that.
Yeah. It's and whether this team is going to be able to come up with it, who knows.
And it's not over. I mean,
no, it's by no means over.
There's about 50 games left in the regular season.
And I think the Yankees and the Red Sox play about half of those against each other. Is that right?
And Aaron Judge has been out. So, you know, monster bat coming back into lineup. Anything is possible. But Red Sox are just clicking on all cylinders. We've talked about this four-game series. We haven't even mentioned Steve Pierce, of all people.
Yeah, that's
having
weird.
A three-home run game in the first game of the series. You know, you add a bat like that to the mix of MVP candidates, Mookie Betts and J.D. Martinez. You know, you got guys like Benintendi who had the winning hit last night. It's just an awesome lineup.
Yeah, it's a... And then you got Mookie Betts playing second base. And I guess that could lead us into the next piece of it. So the old days, you grew up as a Red Sox fan. So who was your super utility guy back when?
Oh, gosh.
Like, I can go back to the Dodgers, and I think about, like, Daryl Thomas played everywhere except pitcher and catcher. You think about the Cardinals. You think of Jose Oquendo. It seemed like everybody had a utility guy who hit about 230 and you could play him anywhere. So somebody would get hurt for a week or miss a game, and there's Darrell Thomas in center field.
Well, here's my thought. What you're getting to is this article that you found on positionless baseball and how the Milwaukee Brewers have really been doing a great job with it. And I started thinking about the different eras and how baseball's changed. And when I looked back to that 80s and 90s period, I didn't think of these great utility players. What I thought of was how when you thought of some sort of rotation of defensive positioning, you didn't really get past maybe a fourth outfielder, or you know, you'd have some sort of a platoon maybe in left field or right field with a left-handed hitter and a right-handed hitter. And then maybe you'd have one infielder who could play second, short, and third. But that was about it. That was the general extent of shifting guys around on a regular basis to a different defensive position. But now it's changed a lot, and teams like the Brewers have taken it to a whole new level that I don't think anybody really would have expected back in the 80s and 90s, where they've got guys who are just excellent hitters that they got to get in the lineup. And they're rotating guys from third to second to first to left field, you know, all around the field every day.
Have you ever heard of something called the defensive spectrum in baseball?
No.
Okay, so it's interesting. I don't know who came up with it. Bill James will make reference to it from time to time. We still need to get him on the show at some point. But the way that the defensive spectrum works, pitcher and catcher aren't a thing, because you don't say, okay, center field, this isn't Little League. You can't say center fielder going and catch, or center fielder going and pitch. Those are the kicker and punter of your baseball teams, basically. Like, you're not rotating guys in and out. However, the defensive spectrum goes, and this is from easiest to play to hardest.
Okay.
And you can go left.
Don't say first base is easiest.
This is what, you can go left to right. Or you can go right to left on the defensive spectrum, but you don't go left to right.
Okay.
So thinking left, first baseman.
Of course.
Left fielder, yep, of course. playing first base and playing first base well are two different things.
Oh, okay, all right. That's
first
fine,
base,
then.
Left fielder, right fielder, second baseman, center fielder, third baseman, shortstop.
Interesting.
So you have shortstop is the hardest position to play, theoretically, followed by third baseman, followed by center fielder, followed by second, right, left, first.
Yeah, I would have thought center fielder was higher than third base. I'm surprised that center fielder is third on that list.
Yeah, I am too. But the kind of case in point is you could take a guy who's a shortstop when he gets late in his career and make him into a third baseman, Cal Ripken. You could take a guy who's a catcher late in his career and make him into a third baseman, Johnny Bench. You can take a guy who is a second baseman late in his career and put him in the outfield, but you can't take a first baseman late in his career and Rafael Palmeiro and say, go play center field.
Well, that happened with me, and I thought it worked out well.
Okay, but you weren't old.
True.
You know, you wouldn't be like Kent Herbeck, your days at first base are done, go play center field now.
But at the same time, I don't think you would take a third baseman and say, your third base days are done, go play center field. That's why I would put center field above third
and
in this spectrum.
I know that I've seen it. I've also seen it shift the other way where third base, this is just Wikipedia telling me it, so there's a 85% chance that it might be wrong. But it's the moving up the defensive spectrum, getting to a harder position versus the other way around. And that's what I didn't look at regarding the Brewers. Do they have guys who are coming in who are playing more difficult positions that logically you could say, hey, and I guess that's the other thing too. Third base and center field are different. I would say it's much easier to take a center fielder and put him at third base than it is vice versa. But it depends on the skill set.
Yeah, it's really interesting to think about this spectrum. And as it turns out with the Brewers, the players that I was looking at, they are not going up the spectrum like you're talking about. And this all started at the trade deadline when the Brewers acquired a guy that we've always liked, Mike Moustakas from the Royals. And the thing is, they already had a third baseman. Travis Shaw was playing great. So everybody's saying, well, what's going on here? Well, the Brewers, again, their mindset was just, let's just get this other left-handed bat here if we can get him at the right price, and we'll figure it out. So what they've done is, you know, Moustakas goes to third. They have Travis Shaw play some second or play some first. But then, you know, all of a sudden you get really crowded because you move over to first with the Brewers and they've got Jesus Aguilar and Thames,
yeah,
who are, you know, sluggers. And you think, well, we can move one of them to left and you've got Ryan Braun out there. So they are kind of going down the spectrum where you guys have shifting from third to second to first and maybe out to left. You don't have guys shifting over to short or out to center where you've got Lorenzo Cain.
Yeah, I was going to say, it almost feels like a men's softball kind of thing where there are certain there are certain positions that don't move, and there are some positions that guys will move around, like Cain and Christian Yelich aren't moving anywhere. They're playing well. Cain's 32, which every time I look at him shocks me. Sometimes you see him walk and he's walking slow, like he's old and he's hurt, and then he moves like lightning. And Cain to me is a young 32. He doesn't have a whole lot of miles on his body, which is probably because he got rescued off the JV baseball field. That's one of my favorite baseball stories. You heard that?
Well, he joined baseball late, right?
Yeah, he had never played basketball. He got cut from the basketball, or he never played baseball, got cut from the basketball team. I don't remember what he was doing. He was messing around doing something, or the baseball coach walked into practice and was like, why did this guy, not even why did he get cut, but I need guys on my baseball team, come play.
Yeah, I need some athletes.
I need athletes. And the next thing you know, Lorenzo Cain was there and starring. I mean, and he's got the advantage of being 6'2", 205, and fast to begin with, but he's also a smart dude, yeah, and a heady player and an athlete.
Yeah, they're happy with him in center and Yelich out and right. And so I think it comes down to five positions, including DH. So you've got third, second, first, left field, and DH, where they're starting to rotate all these hitters. And they really do move guys around. You know, the stat that came out of that article you find was a stat called defensive games played. They rank second in the majors in that statistic, and that just means how many guys do you have at a position in one game, and then you add that up over the course of the season. So if you have three different guys play third base in one game, that counts as three defensive games played.
Yes.
So to be second in that stat, that just means they're really shuffling their lineup a lot and moving guys around every night.
Yes, and it's crazy and it's impressive, and I'm going to correct the defensive spectrum, the actual Bill James spectrum. First, left, right, third, center, second, short.
There we go. Bill James, this confirms that Bill
Wikipedia
James...
Wikipedia is wrong and Bill James is right.
Bill James is greater than Wikipedia.
Yes. Oh, yeah, 100%. But the defensive spectrum, so you could theoretically move, and logically, second to short in your career, you could move center to third in your career, but you could not go from... Going from third to short is hard.
Right.
There's far more lateral movement, far more athleticism required. Although it's funny, though, with the shifts, I was watching the Astros play the other night. I don't remember who was trying to steal second, but a throw down to second base, they were in a defensive shift. That's your standard 2-5 caught stealing.
Yeah,
Bregman,
right.
Alex Bregman was covering second, because if you're scoring a baseball game, a player is in his position. He's in his declared position until he's not.
Regardless of where he stands on the field.
Regardless of where he's standing on the field. So, and that... kind of makes it hell if you're broadcasting a game, you write 5-3, hey, grounded out to third his last time up. Well, the third baseman happened to be playing in shallow right.
Exactly.
Spray charts. All right. Yeah, on that note. So a little bit of baseball talk here. It's fun when you can throw the TV on and that's what people are talking about up here. It's fun when you throw it on and those are the national stories. And you look at the way that the fortune favors different teams. What was it, a month ago, 5 weeks ago, we were talking about the Seattle Mariners as what happened here. These guys are the future. They got cold. The A's got hot. And here we are. Now the A's are the wild card because nobody's winning the West outside of the Astros.
That's right. And that's why 50 games left, Sox are up 9.5. It's not over.
No.
A lot can change.
Yes. Double jeopardy. The scores can really change. And last but not least, this is completely random. I don't know if it was on your list. Allegedly, this is Mike Socha's last year.
Allegedly.
19 years. And it's just weird how your brain plays tricks on you. He still, to me, is the young guy who's supposed to replace Steve Yeager.
Well, not anymore. I think he's 60.
He is 60.
And he's finishing up the 10th year of a 10-year contract, which is kind of fun in and of itself.
It's our day. It's, that is how the Angels roll.
But, you know, he did come out the next day and called that report poppycock.
Which is something that I don't know that any of us are allowed to say unless you're of a certain age.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what exactly that means, but it seems like he's left open the possibility that either he's going to retire, or maybe he'll go manage somewhere else, or maybe he'll sign a new contract with the Angels.
Anything's possible, so we'll see. It wouldn't surprise me to see them keep him around. The other name that I would throw in the mix for the Angels, oddly enough, is Joe Maddon, if Social were to leave. That would not surprise me in the least.
It would surprise me.
It wouldn't surprise me. He's a guy who spent so much time in that Angels system, working all the way up from the minors, being the minor league coordinator, cross checker, you name it. He has done everything in that system. It wouldn't surprise me that he would want to finish his career in sunny Southern California.
Well, from that perspective, yeah. But don't you think he's pretty happy with what's been happening in Chicago?
I think he's pretty happy. But again, it's one of those things that just, it wouldn't surprise me to see it happen. Because it's got to be a big name that goes in there, which is weird how things have changed from the days of Gene Mauch.
Yeah, I mean,
John McNamara.
While you've got Pujols, Trout, and Ohtani, you might as well have someone in there who's planning to try and take them to the next level and win in the postseason. It's not a time of development.
No, not at all. Not at all. So, all right, on that note, we're going to take a quick break, talk about golf for a little bit, and then we're going to record the rest of the show from Missouri. So back after this, you're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Back here on Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1 and a little bit of PGA Tour action where we'll be watching live. It's weird to me that we'll be watching the PGA Championship.
Yeah, it's a major.
In person. It is major.
Fourth major of the year. 100th PGA Championship. And this edition is at a course with a par 70, 35 on both sides. Only two par 5s on the course, which I think is going to be interesting. Guys like Tiger just feast on par 5s. And they can really take advantage of having four par 5s over the course of four different rounds. So we don't have that. And we've got a tough course with a really tough finish that I think is going to be fun to watch. And as you're looking over the weekend, knowing that if there's a playoff in the PGA, it's a three-hole playoff of holes 16, 17, and 18. And what are those holes in St. Louis? 16th hole is a par 3 that's 237 yards. That's no easy task. 17th hole, par 5, almost 600 yards, is 597. And then a nice, healthy 18th hole par 4 that's 457. And did a little background check on what's been happening with the course as they got ready for this event. They've tried to make it a little bit tougher. They've made all the bunkers around the green tighter and deeper. And the only thing they've done to give the competitors a little bit of a breather is on the 11th hole, it's turned into a potentially drivable par 4. It's listed at 355 yards. And what they did is they actually moved a pond that was in front of the green.
Cool.
And they moved it to the right of the green. So a little bit a different course prep than what we heard about from Ken Hamill at Goffstown in the New Hampshire Open, where they're just focusing on setting the tees, you know, cutting the greens twice in the morning to get everything ready. You know, this is about really orchestrating a course and making changes to get ready for this event. They also redid all the greens, and they added some ridges so that they could try and create three or four different quadrants on each green to make it more challenging. So that'll be fun to see over the weekend, is the contrast between guys potentially driving the par four on the 11th and then having to deal with this really tough finishing three-hole stretch.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch those guys come in. I hadn't realized when we were talking, when we were recording the show on Friday, how long in the day those tee times go. So we're going to have some guys going late in the day, still cranking along And hopefully we'll be able to watch some of what they do later in the round as well, to see how those guys manage it. Because again, with a tournament like that, yeah, you can't afford to let it go early. You can't get too far out of it, of course, because you have to make the cut. But again, it's not how you start, it's how you finish.
That's right. That's right. It's a marathon. I think it's 156 players, and their tee times range from 6:50 in the morning until 2:32 in the afternoon local time.
Right.
That was a full day of golf.
Yeah.
You know, exciting field top to bottom.
Right. And then they've also stacked it where you have on Friday, some of the marquee players are playing late in the day. So I guess it's the to the victor or former victors go the spoils. You get to sleep in, you get to have a nice breakfast. You get the you don't get the wake up call at 4 a.m. to go hit golf balls in the dark at the range or chip or putt.
Yeah, they've set it up well for primetime coverage on Friday.
It's like being on the pole. Yeah.
Yeah. They got Phil going at 1:26 in the afternoon with Jason Day and then Phil's Ryder Cup buddy Keegan Bradley. And then two groups after that, you've got Tiger Woods, Rory McIlroy, and the defending PGA champ Justin Thomas, who just won last week at Firestone. So, you know, the PGA knows how to set things up for exciting viewing, and so that's what we'll be following on Friday afternoon.
Right, and you have to go. I mean, if you're starting at 6:50 in the morning, it took me, and your mileage may vary, it took me until 7:06, so the fourth group, to recognize a name, Brant Snedeker.
Yeah, well, there are 20...
Sneds.
There are
Who called him Sneds?
Tiger.
Okay, that's right.
Sneds, Stads. He's got Sansy for Steve. He's got nicknames for everybody. But there's 20 PGA professionals, you know, guys like Ken Hamill, who've qualified for this tournament.
Yeah.
They had a tournament out in California, too. So you've got 20 names right off the bat that you're probably not going to recognize.
Right. Oh, of course. The I think a nickname isn't truly a nickname if it's a derivation of your last name. Like for me, Foxy is not a nickname. I was born with that. Hance is not a nickname.
No.
Calling you Science is a nickname.
That qualifies.
It's fair. It makes sense. You have to earn the nickname. The as I was going over some of the press materials for the PGA tournament as well, and we're going to leave it after we talk about this for a minute, my favorite PGA tournament, hands down. Hands down. Do you have one? Not tournament. PGA Championship tournament.
You mean like a moment?
My favorite major, all told, my favorite PGA major as a thing ever.
Tell me what it is.
It was in 1991, John Daly.
Yeah, he was like the seventh alternate.
He was the ninth alternate. Nick Price had a baby, or his wife had a baby, more accurately. And so they said...
That was 91. Do you know who won in 92?
No.
Nick Price.
Nah.
Do you know where?
Karma. Where?
Belrive.
Nice. They asked the sixth alternate. He said no. Seventh alternate. He said no. Eighth alternate. He says no. Ninth alternate is John Daly. He puts down his Diet Coke and his Marlboro Light. Says, hold my beer, and goes out and wins the tournament.
Yeah, he like, drives all night to get there.
From Dardanelle, Arkansas, and wins at Crooked Stick in Carmel, Indiana. Indiana Carmel?
Can't beat that story.
So anyway, yeah. So there we go. Who knows? We might have one of those come Sunday. We will catch you from the 816, or no, the 314. That's the other side of the state. Yeah, 816 is the left side of the state. So, and that's it for us right now. You are listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox and Andrew Hansen. And it is a little bit of a different experience right now. We're taking our show on the road. We are in the media center at the PGA Championship. It is Friday, so you'll be listening to the show tomorrow. They just announced that play has been suspended for the rest of the day today. Hansen, I guess I'm the curse. I show up at the course, and what happens immediately? Show up, literally walk onto the grounds, and I hear an air horn, and all of a sudden I'm the salmon swimming upstream.
Yeah, seriously. I was walking along the ninth hole watching Phil Mickelson's group, and he had just hit his approach shot to the green. When I heard the horn, I knew that you were going to be here soon.
Yeah.
And come to find out, you timed it so that as you're coming in, apparently all the fans were starting to leave.
Yeah.
Because we started to hear some talk about some quarter-sized hail possibly coming. And after about an hour and a half of a rain delay here, you may have been able to hear the rain on the top of the media center. They have suspended play until 7 a.m. tomorrow morning.
It's getting a little bit loud. When we got here, we ran into Julius Mason from the PGA, and he let us know at that point in time they were hoping that it was going to blow through in about half an hour. But he was saying, man, dime-sized hail. And, of course, what we got was a long, extended storm, basically. The kind that you get, we've been getting a lot up in the east this year, but this is more of a Midwestern storm where all of a sudden it shows up out of nowhere, and usually what happens is it will subside, but in this case, this thing has just been going and cranking. But it's been an interesting day. You were here, you got to see a lot of golf. I have seen really nothing except for sweaty people and media, and a lot of international media. We had the opportunity briefly to talk to Michael Collins from ESPN, hoping that he'll be able to join us later, as well as Rick Riley, who is now of The Athletic. So we have spoken to some people, and everybody's kind of got the same sort of overwhelming malaise of, we were here for a golf tournament, and now we're stuck inside. This, and there are worse things, like you walk around the corner, there's food and beverages, but this isn't quite what any of these guys signed up for. Tomorrow morning, right after the, actually it's not long after the show gets on the air, they will get back out, play in the morning. 7 a.m. is when they start. Guys will know at the end of the completion of their second round, if they haven't already, did they make the cut or not? And then they'll know at 11:15, all right, do you go again? So some of these guys, in some of those cases, may play as many as 32 holes, weather permitting, tomorrow.
Yeah, it'll be a real challenge for those guys to ramp up early in the morning and then not quite know when they'll have to play again. You may have to take a lengthy break before their third round tee time. But you mentioned the storms in the air, and there's been a storm of birdies today.
Yeah.
And it's a shame that play had to be suspended and then postponed until tomorrow, because there were some record-tying scores shot today. 7-under was the number. Brooks Koepka shot a 7-under par 63 on this par 70 course, as well as Schwartzel. And I had a chance to watch Koepka come to the last hole for him, which was the ninth green. And it was really a fascinating situation, because he was 7-under coming into the ninth hole. And if he made birdie, all right, that would have given him a 62. And it would have been the all-time lowest round in a PGA Championship ever shot.
It's the conditions were ripe for it. You talked about those two. Tony Finau played one of the weirdest nine holes in the history of the PGA. You called that to my attention. Seven birdies, a triple bogey, and a bogey. So after all that work, he winds up 3-under for nine. But just consistently inconsistent. He's one that was first brought to our attention back in April, right before the Masters. It was the hole-in-one competition. He hits a hole-in-one, goes running down the course, dislocates his ankle. We talked about that on the air at that point. But he is certainly one to watch as far as the swing. He's a little bit taller than your typical golfer, but he is one to watch. And after all that, though, he may have some difficulty making the cut. So it has been interesting to see. And some of these guys, you mentioned Phil Mickelson. Phil has one more hole to play tomorrow to basically ensure that he doesn't make the cut.
Yeah, so you mentioned Finau, and it's been a fascinating 2 days for him, because he has been playing with Jim Furyk, who is the Ryder Cup captain. And he is one of those players who may be on the bubble for automatic qualification. Will he be a captain's pick? So there was a lot of chatter coming into the week of how would he perform playing in the same group as Jim Furyk. And yesterday, it seemed like maybe the pressure got to him a little bit. He shot 4 over par. But then how did he start today? Well, he was right back on track. As you mentioned, 7 birdies on the front nine. And then he also birdied the 11th hole. So he played 11 holes today. He made 8 birdies. So he obviously came in with a better mindset today, and he got it figured out in terms of, you know, how to perform under the eye of the captain.
But you have to ask yourself, what would he have shot if he was wearing flip-flops? Just saying.
Probably a 47.
47, most likely, for 18. So, talking about all that sort of stuff there, it has been interesting to be sitting in here. I said it to you earlier. Feels like we're sitting in a sports book. There are a number of basically rows of cubicles that are – we are in the back row, which is shorthand for not very important. But that's okay. I'm cool with that as long as I'm here.
Everybody has to start in the back row at some point.
Everybody has to start in the back row. I don't know that I have aspirations of moving further up in the room, but looking around the rest of the room, there are some areas where people are doing live radio shows. Those guys are set up in the back. They did have an interview room. You saw Kansas alum Gary Woodland, who was back in there, who is the leader in the clubhouse right now. And then the print media and the online media are further up in the front of the room, and the PGA staff are directly behind us. But there are screens that I'm going to tell you, it's a solid 90 feet of screens wide by, I'm going to say, 20 feet high of nothing except golf scores. And if you are a golf fan, and we'll post it on the Fox on Sports Facebook page, but if you are a golf fan, being in somewhere like this, particularly on a day like this when it's raining and nobody wants to be outside, there's really nowhere better to be. This is the place to be.
Yeah, and to extend that description, the screen is so big and the print is so small that you have every single golfer in the field with their scores for every single hole in this round up on this board, and then you've got the actual leaderboard in the middle. So it's a one-stop shopping for all the information you need. And you mentioned the interview I watched with Gary Woodland. It seems like a different day because it was back midday when he had just finished his round, and he's on top of the board at 10 under. He had a putt on the ninth hole, his last hole today for birdie, and it was right in the middle. It came up about 3 inches short. So he almost went – see, he was 6 under on the first day, so 64. He shot a 66 today. Wonderful start. And – I enjoyed the interview because he got to talk about, you know, being a Kansas Jayhawk.
Yeah.
And he mentioned that he heard a few Rock Chalk Jayhawks from the fans.
Sure. I saw a lot of people walking around wearing KU stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's everywhere. We're only a few hours from Lawrence, Kansas, where he played. But he also mentioned that there were some Missouri chants, you know, because they're obviously the big rival. So it was a mixture here in St. Louis of, you know, pro-Missouri fans and pro-Kansas fans. You know, with a watchful eye on Woodland, and you know, he's off to a great start. But I want to get back to the ninth hole because that's where I was. Like I said, when Brooks Koepka came with a shot at history at 62, and he had a great approach shot, went right over the pin, had a 15-foot birdie putt coming back down the hill to shoot 62, and it lipped out.
Yep.
You know, it was really a dramatic moment. So a lot of fun to see that. And then Kevin Kisner, he also came to that green 7-under for the day with a shot to shoot 62. But he took a chip that went about 15 feet past the pin, missed his putt coming back, made bogey. Seemed like the pressure got to him a little bit. So it was really fascinating to see all that action on the ninth green.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing, and we've talked about the mental aspect of sports a lot over the course of the last year. But what runs into your brain when you have an opportunity to set a course record, to exceed whatever your expectations that you had for yourself were, and all of a sudden you've been playing nice and loose, and then you get to the last hole, you become very tight. I'll never forget I had a day where years ago when I was playing a lot, I had a chance to break 80, and you get to 17, and I'm like, all I have to do is go bogey, bogey, and I went like triple and bogey and wound up with an 82. You know, but the things that enter in your brain at that point that you tend to kind of become your own worst enemy then, and it looked like that might have been the case for him as well.
Yeah, it is funny how there can be a unique situation where the pressure will just come all of a sudden if you kind of stop and think about where you are in a given round or a given tournament. And it's kind of funny how it's Friday midday, so it's the second round of a tournament, and you just wouldn't think that all of a sudden there's going to be a major pressure situation. But these guys know when they're shooting for a 62, they know what's at stake. So I just thought it was fascinating to see Kisner really seem to be affected by the pressure of the moment.
Yeah, it's it is nothing if not a mental game. And the other thing, the physical aspect of it. And you brought it to my attention. I hadn't seen it because obviously I didn't see anything today because it was like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. But the Tiger Woods swing versus the Rory McIlroy swing. And if you want to describe it a little bit for the listeners, I can kind of fill in some gaps. But at least what you saw, and you did video both swings, both of them have great golf swings, but vastly different golf swings.
Yeah, so we were positioned on the fifth fairway, and it was an approach shot of probably 120 to 140 yards up the hill. And, you know, that just reminds me, before we get to the swings, you cannot really appreciate how challenging these courses are and how good these guys are until you're actually out here and you can see the undulations and the change in elevation. I mean, visually, that shot that they were facing, it was just way uphill, huge bunkers, and, you know, all these guys just passed with flying colors. But with Rory, his swing, it just is so natural-looking and beautiful and effortless. It's just an amazing thing to see. And then you look at Tiger, and he obviously has one of the greatest swings. He's been one of the greatest of all time in terms of, you know, refining his swing and changing his swing a few times and getting his game back to top form. But his swing to me it's just a little bit more muscular and forced than Rory. And maybe nobody can quite compare to Rory with his swing. Everybody praises him as maybe the best ball striker. And there's nobody quite like Tiger Woods, but you know, his swing is just a little bit more mechanical, I think, than Rory's.
It's interesting to watch both of them. The single word that I think of when I think of Tigers is violent. And it's not, it is a rapid swing. You can watch the swing and understand, because it is a variation of what his swing was back in the 90s. But it is a violent swing, and it is a swing that you can look back now and say, all right, I can understand how he would have had some physical difficulties trying to use that swing. And it's kind of like all of us were back in the 90s. Like, it's the Chick Stigg long ball era. It's I want to stripe it right down the middle, 300 yards era. It's the I want to bench press 315 pounds once era. And you've seen my impression of that, where it's like I'm going to bow my back as much as I can so that I have to move the bar about 2 inches. But hey, I did 315 pounds. That was that place and time where it was like, we're going to muscle everything. In the last 20 years, people have been way smarter about biomechanics and realizing that big muscles versus small muscles, your legs are your bigger muscles, your core, your lats, those are your bigger muscles, your smaller muscles are your arms. Those are the ones that are just kind of along for the ride with everything. So Rory really uses his core strength, and it's because he's able to fire his core that quickly that the club is able to clear quickly, and he doesn't have a long backswing, whereas Tiger will get longer, but there's so much violence going right to the ball that really has caused him some physical issues over the year. And you look at Rory, that's probably what's going to make his swing be more built to last as his career continues.
Yeah, and you want to talk about biomechanics and amazing sights. About a half hour before that, I was standing right next to the sixth tee box, which is a long par three, and up come Ricky Fowler and Ian Poulter and Matsuyama. And to be that close to Ricky Fowler, you again, in person, you see something different, which is his stature is so small. I mean, he's probably shorter than you and much more slender.
What are you trying to say, dude?
I mean, I'm just saying he's you look at him and it, you know, think of a baseball, you'd think of him as a second baseman.
Okay.
All right. And but he's
so
not
like junior. Okay.
And he's slender. He doesn't really have any sort of muscle mass. You talk about core strength. I think that's where his power comes from, cuz he can hit long distances, and so it was just amazing to see him up close and to see how he uses his body and is able to generate enough swing speed to be able to compete with all these guys on a course that's, again, 7,300 yards and only par 70.
Yeah, it's been wonderful to see him. He has played well so far. As we speak now, Ricky Fowler, 2-under today, 7-under for the tournament. So playing well, and Rick Riley had written a column earlier. We were hoping to talk to him about it. We may or may not be able to grab him, about Tiger Woods and the guy who is kind of, he's like staring into the sun. And we're all rooting for him. We all want to see the comeback. But there are so many good things to see on the tour, one of which is Ricky Fowler and the young guns who are really playing well. Like, a lot of these guys are the leading lights of the tour, but Tiger came back and, for better or for worse, sucked a lot of the air out of the room.
Yeah, he did. But, you know, with a field like this at a major, you can quickly turn the page, and there are so many great things to see. And, you know, one other thing, you talked about, you know, the heat and the weather conditions, and it's been hot and humid out here. Another thing that jumped out at me as I was watching Poulter and Ricky Fowler on that tee was that it was only the sixth hole, and Ian Poulter was completely drenched in sweat from head to toe. You know, so it's a real physical challenge for these guys. Another thing that jumped out at me was just watching the interaction between player and caddy. And on that tee box, I noticed how Ian Poulter walked off the yardage for himself and didn't really talk to his caddy. Whereas with Ricky Fowler, Ricky Fowler's caddy walked it off, you know, and then they talked for a minute. So it's just always fun to see how different players and caddies sort of strategize and communicate in different ways. Then there's sort of the fun stuff, the unexpected stuff. You're talking about the weather. I saw one of the players walking down the fairway with an umbrella over his head, and I quickly realized, well, it's so hot out here. He's trying to, you know, stay in the shade to be able to, you know, play at his peak for all 18 holes.
Right. It's that's been a fact, and that's been something you have to deal with. I mean, for me, I didn't walk terribly far. I walked, I'm going to say maybe 3/4 of a mile to get from the bus to the media center, but I was drenched by the time I got here. Looked like I had taken a shower. And of course, you look at the weather now, like, if you had been outside at all over the course of the last couple hours, you would have looked like you needed to take a shower as well. So it has been an odd mix. The other, you look at what the rest of us, the kind of garden variety golfers do, and this was a new thing to me, I hadn't seen it in ages, is play with people, and everybody's got these little viewfinders that tell you how far it is to the hole. Well, these guys don't use those. I hadn't played golf in long enough that I saw people pulling viewfinders, and I'm like, what's this? But these guys aren't permitted to use anything like that. They are required to step it off themselves, have a caddy step it off, know where the pin placements are. So there is a lot of strategy that goes into that. Not to mention, these guys are good enough that they're reading the greens from 100 yards out and knowing, okay, or if not more, and knowing, all right, if I stick it and it's going to spin back, how do I have to play into any of those undulations on the green in order to get the ball where I want to give myself a makeable birdie putt? Those are things that the rest of us that are the Sunday golfers can't fathom.
Yeah, and when you talk about yardage, and it reminds me of that other aspect that we've touched on with the change in elevation on some of these approach shots. But getting back to that ninth hole, as I saw Phil Mickelson approach the ninth with his fairway shot, it struck me that the change in elevation was just really dramatic. And there's no tool that you can use that will tell you if you're, you know, on the ground, you're 150 yards away, how much do you have to change your shot due to the elevation? Do you club up, you know, one club, two clubs? Is it worth 20 yards? And so it puts a big value on how the caddy can contribute to the team.
Right. It's and the trust that has to exist between the golfer and the caddy in order for any of this stuff to work, because you're only allowed so many opportunities as a caddy to make a suggestion that's bad. Because, hey, golfer makes the shot, he's the one who ultimately gets the credit. If he takes your advice and your advice is bad, well, or if he makes the shot in spite of you, well, it's you kind of got a short leash. So if you're that guy, you really have to earn the trust of the guy whose clubs you're holding, and that's really a big challenge. So just to give an update too on the baseball front, because we can't go a week without talking about Grant Levine, and rightfully so, but the Pioneer League, which is a rookie league out in the Plain States, I guess I'll call it, the Mountain States, you know, there are teams in Colorado, Montana, Idaho, the Pioneer League, rookie level league, took on the Northwest League, which is a short season A league. So may not sound like much. It's one rung on the ladder. However, you're talking, I haven't looked at the numbers. I'm going to guess it's somewhere between a year and 2 years average difference among these players. I'm also going to go out on a limb and guess that Grant was probably the youngest of all the players on either roster, just given what I know. And
he's still 18, right?
Yeah, he's still 18. He doesn't turn 19 till the end of the month. Well, Grant had a couple at-bats in the game, wound up getting on base on an error by the pitcher, Emmanuel Chase, for the Northwest League. He scored the 12th run of the game for the Pioneer League. Ultimately, the rookie players, the Pioneer League players, beat the short A players 13-10. So Grant is getting a taste, as Patty Arnold from the Grand Junction Sentinel reminded us last week. Grant's getting a taste of just about everything that this first year of baseball really has to offer him, and curious to see what the offseason holds. Of course, he's still got a couple more weeks of the season, but curious to see what the offseason holds, and I would say that next year you and I would do an episode of Fox on Sports from Asheville, North Carolina, if indeed that's where he's playing. That's where the Rockies low A in the South Atlantic League is, and folks down in McCormick Field would accommodate us to do a little bit of Fox on Sports from down there in North Carolina. So it's been interesting to see, and will be interesting to continue to watch the rest of the season.
I'm a fan of North Carolina. I spent a summer down there. We're gonna make a road trip down there. Is that the plan?
That was 2003. We went down there. I of course rode the bus. Jenny drove down. No kids at that point, but that was my favorite baseball road trip, favorite baseball destination. I haven't been there in 15 years, so would welcome the opportunity to go back and check out a little bit of Sally League baseball, which, surprisingly enough, everybody says, yeah, A-ball, what does it really have to offer? I think the team that we had in 2003, we sent 11 or 12 guys to the major leagues from that team. So it is certainly high-quality baseball, and even at that point, you can watch guys. I remember watching Hanley Ramirez, B.J. Upton, Matt Cain. You can watch those guys and go, yep, that guy's a major leaguer, that guy's a major leaguer, that guy's an organizational guy. So it really is an opportunity to watch the cream sort of rise to the top a bit.
Yeah, that'll be fun. So I'm up for planning on that, because this has been a lot of fun to be out here with you chatting in St. Louis on the grounds of the 100th PGA Championship. By the way, this is the last time the PGA is going to be played in August. They're moving it to May. It's going to be the second major played on every calendar year moving forward. So a little bit of history here. And oh, by the way, who did you see coming in? Was that the Wizard that you saw?
Yeah, that was exciting. So I'm walking in, and who do I see? And you talk about guys who are built like second baseman. Well, he should be. He's a shortstop. But Ozzie Smith, who's about my size, and I said, hey, Ozzie, what's up? And he waved back, said, hey, how are you? You know, so I was shocked. Like, he is, I don't know what the official title is, it's escaped me, but he is the Grand Marshal, or whatever it is, of the PGA Championship this year at Bellerive. They had some great media events with a lot of St. Louis luminaries at them, and Ozzie was chief among them, and I kind of went, wait a second, was that for real that dude just walked by? So, utterly shocking, but yeah, fun to be part of this, and thankful for the folks of the PGA who gave us the opportunity to do this. So with that said, thank you to Harry Kozlowski, as always, for producing the show. We're going to send him this episode at about 6:40 Eastern time. He'll stitch it all together. You'll be able to listen to it, or you have already listened to it. And thanks to everybody at Betfair 105.1, including Bill, Chris, and Colleen for all their hard work. And we will catch you next week. Enjoy the sports week, and we will talk to you then. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Betfair 105.1.